we continue our readings from the books of Samuel. And in this case, we read as King Saul became jealous of David, who stayed at the king's court at that time. David suspected that Saul wanted to harm him, kill him even, and so asks Jonathan to observe his father's response when David did not turn up to an important festival gathering of the court.
First book of Samuel, chapter 20, verses starting at verse 24. So David hid in the field, and when the new moon festival came, the king sat down to eat. He sat in his customary place by the wall. Jonathan sat opposite him, and Abner sat next to Saul, but David's place was empty. Saul said nothing that day, for he thought, something must have happened to David to make him ceremonially unclean. Surely he is unclean. But the next day, the second day of the month, David's place was empty again. Then Saul said to his son Jonathan, why hasn't the son of Jesse come to the meal, either yesterday or today? Jonathan answered, David earnestly asked me for permission to go to Bethlehem. He said, let me go, because our family is observing a sacrifice in the town, and my brother has ordered me to be there. If I have found favour in your eyes, let me go to see my brothers. That is why he has not come to the king's table. Saul's anger flared up at Jonathan, and he said to him, you son of a perverse and rebellious woman, don't I know that you have sided with the son of Jesse? So your own shame and to the shame of the mother who bore you? As long as the son of Jesse lives on this earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Now send and bring him to me, for he must die. Why should he be put to death? What has he done? Jonathan asked his father. But Saul hurled his spear at him to kill him. Then Jonathan knew that his father intended to kill David. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God. The Holy Gospel according to John, chapter 14. Do not let your hearts be troubled. Trust in God. Trust also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you. I am going there to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you with me, that you also may be where I am. You know the way to the place where I am going. Thomas said to him, Lord, we don't know where you are going, so how can we know the way? Jesus answered, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you really knew me, you would know my Father as well. From now on, you do know him and have seen him. This is the gospel of Christ. Praise to Christ the Word.
I suspect that you may have known quite a few married couples who at Christmas and other important occasions were torn between their families. The question may be, should we visit his parents in Christchurch or her parents in Dunedin for Christmas? Maybe that couple were at one family home for Christmas dinner and rushed to get to Boxing Day the very next day. Maybe they had Christmas at his parents one year and at her parents the other. Even when children come along, it is still often customary to have big family get-togethers And the larger the families and the more dispersed the children, the harder it actually is to get them all together. Sometimes there can be a few feelings of guilt if the couple are not able to make it to one or the other of the family celebrations, and their family loyalty may even be questioned. I have to say, we don't have that problem. Our parents live on different sides of the world, so we can't make it from one celebration to the other, even if we wanted to. And since I've entered the ministry, there's no question where we are spending Christmas and Easter. Our reading from the book of Samuel is also about a festival and family loyalty. But in that case, the stakes were a lot higher than deciding where the holidays might be spent. And today you might have today will be my more historical sermon on the books of Samuel, but that needs to be now and then. So, at the heart of the conflict was the question which house of the father David and Jonathan were loyal to. House of the father? Well, did we hear that in the readings? Well, we didn't. Because in most translations, the phrase house of the father or father's house is not there. But it is in the original Hebrew, and it is variously translated as family, home, or house. But the father's house is the basis of the society in ancient Israel. Once we understand that, we can see that the Bible is full of stories of wisdom, advice, poetry, and parables that reflect this family relationship. The house of the father was the basic family unit in ancient Israel. Normally, it would be the family around the oldest surviving male and his descendants and dependents. So normally, the house of the father would be a household of a multi-generational family. You might have grandfather and grandmother, their unmarried daughter and son, and their married sons with wives and children. This extended family may have lived in one house or in a complex of several adjacent houses, as you see on the screen, not there. They worked the fields together, organized the household, and generally were dependent on each other. When the father relinquished the control or died, the household may split, with each of the sons founding a house of the father, so to say. Because the growth of a particular family fluctuates so that at times more living space was needed, at times less, sometimes more fields, sometimes less, the family was part of the clan. Because fields and property were held by the clan. They were assigned for use within the clan, possibly through some lease or sale agreement at times. But property could normally not be sold outside the clan. The clan also often held some resources in common, for example, a pair of oxen. These were used in ploughing. It would not have been worthwhile for each family to have all their own animals that were required only infrequently throughout the year. For example, a house of the father of the clan might own the oxen to here, the other might own a particular bull for mating with cows, and one might have owned a few more donkeys than the other. So it was a sort of cooperative. For centuries, the clan also was the basic military unit in Israel. When Israel went to war, its basic organization was that of the clan. Each clan would send a number of men together to the army, which was led by one of the cousins. So that way, cousins who knew each other well would fight together. Well, one disadvantage of that system was in particularly heavy fighting, the entire fighting group of a clan might be wiped out, and so there might be very few men back at home. The different clans came together as a tribe. We know of the famous 12 tribes of Israel. The tribe was really the overarching group of loyalty. Whether to go to war or not, for example, was decided on the tribal level, and justice was also dispensed on the tribal level. Later on, a king was set above the tribes. Some of the tribal structures were weakened by the new royal administration, but many tribal structures persisted and were apparently even strengthened. So there were several levels of belonging in ancient Israel. First of all, a person back then was part of Israel. So they were descended from the house, from the ancestors Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And sometimes being part of Israel also meant to be loyal to God, the Lord, to Yahweh. Later on, there was the kingdom, whether that was the United Kingdom or the Northern and Southern Kingdom. Then further closer, it was the tribe which decided on justice, on war and peace. Then in the circle was the clan, which was used for resource use, so you shared resources together. Then you were part of the house of the father, which was the main unit. It was the economic family unit that lived together. And finally, you had the nuclear family, father, mother, and children, which was based on immediate descent. So conceptually, the house of the father was the main unit in ancient Israel, where most of a person's life was spent, which a person supported by their work, and to which they gave, first of all, their loyalty. Now, in our reading from 1 Samuel, such family loyalties are tested. As a servant in King Saul's household, David is supposed to show greater loyalty to Saul than to his own house of the father. As a loyal servant, he would nearly assume the identity of a son of Saul, though with less privileges than one of Saul's real sons. His main identity would not be the son of Jesse. And if you listen closely to our readings and read previously Saul called David, David. And from this time onwards, he calls him son of Jesse. So you see that there's a split in loyalty. Jonathan, of course, is the son of King Saul, but he's also David's ally. Earlier in the book of Samuel, it tells a story that describes how Jonathan would have made a better king than his father Saul. Jonathan, however, saw that God was with David and placed God's plan for Israel above his own ambitions and family loyalty. David became concerned about the behavior of King Saul. So David decides on a plan to see whether King Saul really thinks of David as an enemy. The plan is not arbitrary. At a time of a banquet in Saul's house, David, who is a servant in Saul's house, stays away. As an excuse, Jonathan is to tell Saul that David is at a sacrifice of David's house of the father, the house of Jesse. In other terms, David considers the loyalty to his house more important than the loyalty to Saul. And we also know that David and Saul were from different tribes. So by choosing to be loyal to his house of the father, David also implicitly says that he puts his tribe above acknowledging Saul. Saul immediately understands where David's loyalties lie. He understands that the popular David is loyal first to his own family, not to Saul's family. So Saul understands that David is a threat. Saul gets enraged that Jonathan does not seem to see this threat. Both Jonathan and David are torn in their loyalties. They remain loyal to their families, but they are also friends. So Jonathan begins to see that David and his family will take the throne of Israel. Rather than fighting for his father's house to remain on the throne, Jonathan sees reality and tries to get the best out of it for his own family. He does not help to kill David, but enters into a covenant with the future king. "When you are king, David," he says, "keep my family safe." Much of the rest of the books of Samuel recount the struggles between the house of Saul and the house of David. It is the struggle between two fathers' houses, so to say. David does keep his promise and keeps the family of Jonathan safe, more or less, though not the other descendants of Saul. Indeed, an important summary of the books of Samuel is later on in the second book of Samuel, which reads, "The conflict between the house of Saul and the house of David lasted a long time. David grew stronger and stronger, while the house of Saul grew weaker and weaker. At the core of these books, then, is also a question of family and tribal loyalty. Now, why all this background? Well, probably first of all, because family loyalties and family economics are some of my main research topics, so I just could not resist the temptation to delve into these topics a little bit. But if we want to understand the Bible, we need to understand part of the culture. If, for example, we dismiss it all as patriarchy, we have not really understood so many references in the Bible. If we understand how important the father's house was in ancient Israel, and that it was the father's house that determined one's loyalties, we can understand many of the assumptions that those who first heard the words of the Bible had. For them, love, for example, was first of all expressed in the father's house within the family. Over time, the importance of the father's house changed. For example, it was not as important in Jesus' time, but some of that Old Testament understanding was still there. If we then hear Jesus' words about the house of the Father with that background in mind, we may understand a bit more about what he was saying. In my Father's house are many dwellings, and that's where I will take you, he told his disciples. In a sense, Jesus seems to say that those who follow him are part of the same father's house, part of the same family. It is a big family for sure, but it is the family from which we get our ultimate identity, to which we have our ultimate loyalty. While that loyalty may still be completely fulfilled in the future, we are already on the way. Therefore, our loyalty to God, the Father, is expressed here by our devotion to Jesus, who is the way to the Father. By referring to the Father's house, Jesus strengthens that image of God's family. Those who follow him are bound together and they are connected to God. The word dwelling that the Gospel of John uses here is a key word in that Gospel. In the Gospel of John, Jesus is often described as dwelling in a place, teaching the people and really being with them. The words indicate a close connection. In other places, the gospel says that the disciples will dwell in Jesus and he in them. They will dwell in his love as Jesus dwells in his Father's love. For the Father dwells in Jesus. So when Jesus talks about the dwellings in the Father's house for his disciples, there's first of all the sense of closeness, connection, and presence. And together with that is a sense of rest and peace, particularly if we hear the Old Testament echoes of the wandering people finally entering in their place of rest, or God dwelling among his people through the tent of the covenant and the law. We read in the Bible, in the New Testament itself, that we enter the rest that God has prepared for us. The house of the Father, then, when we refer to God as our Father, is a place of peace, of comfort, where we are really at home, where our longings are filled, our relationships are set right, and to which our ultimate loyalty belongs. Amen.